time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Camila Mejia. Camila Mejia grew up in Nicaragua and Costa Rica before moving to the United States in 1994. He joined the military at the age of 19, serving as an infantryman in the active duty army for 3 years before transferring to the Florida National Guard. After fighting in Iraq for 5 months, he became the first known Iraq veteran to refuse to fight the war in Iraq, citing moral concerns about the war and occupation. He was eventually convicted of desertion by a military court and sentenced to a year in prison, prompting Amnesty International to declare him a prisoner of conscience. He currently serves as chair of the board of Iraq Veterans Against the War and is the author of the book Road from Ar-Ramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Mejia. Camila, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
If you would begin, start out and tell us about Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Iraq Veterans Against the War was founded in 2004 at the Veterans for Peace Conference by 7 anti-war veterans. And we have 3 main points of unity, you know, which represent our mission and goals, and they are immediate withdrawal from Iraq, you know, of all occupying forces, benefits for all returning veterans, and reparations to the Iraqi people so they can rebuild their country on their own terms. And we're activating chapters. We're creating chapters in we're trying to create chapters in active duty bases. We have about 3 active duty chapters. We have over 50 chapters overall, and we have chapters overseas. We have chapters in Canada. We have chapters in Germany. We have people serving in Iraq. And our main focus is to basically to support and help organize GI resistance to the occupation of Iraq and to bring awareness to the public, because we feel like the public are not being allowed to experience the war. And until that happens, you know, there will be no sense of ownership of the war, and people will not necessarily be really engaged in the movement to bring the troops home. And another one of the main struggles that we have is that of healthcare, you know, for veterans, because we have a crisis right now of post-traumatic stress disorder, suicide, homicide, domestic violence, unemployment, you know, you name it. And, you know, we're going through it. And the response by the government and the VA system has been nothing short of criminal, really. And the other thing, you know, reparations to the Iraqi people. We've been there. We've been the hammer that's inflicted of this pain, all of this pain, onto the Iraqi people and the Afghani people too. So we feel compelled to undo some of the damage that's been caused by the government. So that's the main thing that we have, you know, our main mission.
All right. Tell me a bit about your personal story. How is it that the son of Nicaraguan revolutionaries ended up in the U.S. military?
Well, our history with the U.S. began really early on in my life. We've always had family here, and there was a time in Nicaragua before the actual triumph of the revolution when there was a period of very crude repression, which led to the deactivation of many of the cadre in the movement, including my mother. So because of that, and because of problems, you know, with my dad, you know, they basically got separated when I was just months old. My mom decided to leave the country, and so we came to the U.S. when I was just months old, and we lived in New York for about a year. And then from there, we went to Costa Rica, which is my mom's native country, and once we were there, my mom again got involved with the Sandinista movement. By then, my dad had been exiled in Spain because he's a musician, and his music had turned too radical for the regime to stand, and so he had to leave the country. But once the Sandinistas triumphed, you know, we all went back to Nicaragua, and we stayed there for a period of about maybe 10, 11 years. And during that time, we kept traveling, and we spent some time in Cuba, and we kept coming to the U.S. And then once the Sandinistas lost the election to a coalition of conservative U.S.-supported parties, we left the country once again to go back to Costa Rica, and from Costa Rica we came to the United States, and we've been here ever since. The entire period of the Sandinista Revolution, my parents were well situated in the government, and we lived with you know, in a rather privileged position. And the same is true for when we went to live in Costa Rica. So when we came to the States for the first time, I had to work for a living. I had to wonder, you know, where the money would come from to go to school. You know, I had no health insurance. And it was a big shock for me culturally, socially, in just about every aspect. You know, being still a teenager and having lived in three countries in a two-year period, I had no sense of belonging, I had no benefits, I had no prospects for the future. So in that sense, I wasn't very different from, you know, any young man or woman, you know, who would join the military, you know, as a way to escape poverty and as a way to get, you know, travel and adventure opportunities and to, you know, get their tuition paid for. The military seemed like the perfect way to get all those things. You know, they offer you camaraderie, they offer you fun, travel, adventure, benefits, you know, steady paycheck and all those things. So it seemed like a great thing to do, and that's how I ended up joining the U.S. military.
And they, their promotions are a lot of the things that in some of your programs with IVAW now you are challenging, you know, the benefits and the ability to travel.
Well, you know, let me put it this way. I've, with the U.S. military, I've been to Kuwait, Germany, Scotland, Italy, obviously Iraq, Jordan, but I haven't seen beyond, you know, U.S. military bases in any of those countries. So, you know, the whole idea of travel, you know, wasn't very effective for me. And the main thing, I guess, that people should know is that the main thing when you join the military is the mission, you know. So in my case, for instance, you know, when I got out of active duty and joined the National Guard, you know, they told me, you know, when I transferred to a private university, they said, you know, we really don't pay for school, which they had promised. We get it waived at public institutions, and now that you're going to a private university, you're basically on your own. And by the way, after, you know, we're done waiving your tuition at a public institution, you owe us another 3 years of service. So my original military contract, which was 3.5 years in active duty, turned out to be 8 years, because every military contract is 8 years. And then after that, if I would have continued to receive the benefits, you know, for education, I would have owed the military an extra 3 years. So that 8-year contract would have turned into an 11-year contract. In fact, my contract became like a 30-plus year contract when I was stop loss. You know, I was about to get out of the military right before getting deployed to Iraq. And the company commander said, you know, you've been stop loss and your contract has been extended, you know, to the year 2031. And you have a minimum activation of 2 years to be deployed to the Middle East in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So there's a lot more to say to the story of about the story of benefits, you know, than the recruiters will tell young men and women. I think that one thing to keep in mind is that the number one priority of the military when people join the military is that they serve the mission, whatever it is that whatever the mission is at the time, you know, whatever they tell you to do. It's not necessarily your benefits, you know, your education, your health, or anything like that.
And did you find a lot of other people in the military that had joined for similar reasons to yours?
I think the majority of people join for those reasons. I think certainly, you know, people join with the idea that they're going to serve their country, that they're going to be fighting for freedom and democracy, and they're going to be defending the Constitution. But by and large, the majority of the people who join the military need benefits that they would not be able to get otherwise. So, for instance, you know, I just went to give a talk at this place called Salinas in California, and this is a place where military recruiters get a very high return in their efforts. And the reason is that there's a lot of gang violence, you know, which is the result of poverty. So people in Salinas, you know, they join the military obviously because they want to be patriotic and all that, but because they want to switch their sense of belonging from that of a gang to that of the military. And it seems like the only way out of that violence and the only way out of that really horrible situation is to join the military.
All right. So when in the military did you start to question your service?
Well, I first began to question, you know, the whole idea that the military is a big family and that, you know, we're here to help you and, you know, we're here to make sure that, you know, you advance in life and all that. When I got out of active duty and I went to the National Guard and they told me, you know, we really don't pay for your tuition, and, you know, when every time I had like a final exam or I had to, you know, submit a paper or I needed help from my commanders, they would say, no, you know, training comes first. So it was like, you know, yeah, we're getting your tuition waived at this community college, but at the same time, you know, we don't care if you don't pass your classes. We don't care if you don't have time to study. We don't care if you don't have time to do your paper. So I began to question, I began to ask myself, is this really a place, you know, where they care about your development, where they care about your education, or is this a place where they'll tell you anything in order to get you to join and do whatever they want you to do? So I was very disillusioned with the whole idea of, you know, being in a family and being in a place where, you know, my well-being was a top priority. And I began to question that. I began to question the sincerity of the system. But when I was deployed to Iraq, or just prior to being deployed to Iraq, to me it was pretty unbelievable that we were actually going to invade Iraq, because much was being said about there not being, you know, any evidence, you know, linking Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda, and there was massive world opposition to the possibility of an invasion, including here the United States. The UN Security Council was not approving the war. It was not in self-defense, and therefore was in violation of the supreme law of the land of the United States. And to me, it was pretty incredible that we were still going to deploy and invade a country, you know, in the face of such opposition, you know, legal and moral, and it just was very hard for me to believe. As a matter of fact, when I deployed to Iraq, I still believed that that was going to just be a huge show of force, that we were going to scare Saddam Hussein out of power, and that we were not actually going to really invade, you know, that we were not actually really going to drop bombs. And it was a shocker to me when the invasion began, because I said, how can we do this in absolute violation of international law and U.S. law and world opposition? And to me, it was just like unbelievable. And then I began to question, you know, the whole idea that, you know, we're in this military, you know, that's an agent of good, and that, you know, we're here, you know, to protect democracy and freedom, when in reality, you know, we're going against all of those things, you know, by violating the law, by violating, you know, the public will, by violating just about everything that we stand for.
And when did you start to, when did you move from just mentally questioning these things to actively deciding that you didn't want to participate?
Well, it was a slow process. When we first got to Iraq, actually prior to being in Iraq, I remember that I was very frustrated with the idea that I would be deployed to an occupation, an invasion, an occupation that I disagreed with. And since I was an infantry squad leader and I was in charge of 8 men, I began to take out my frustrations on my squad, and then I realized that what I was doing, and I said, you know, I really began to question, you know, the leadership model that we have in the infantry, which is one based on, you know, punishment and fear and instilling respect through those things, you know, physical punishment and things like that. And then I also said, you know, these men are going to be in Iraq with me in combat, and do I really want them to be afraid of me, or to be angry, or to be resentful of me, or do I want to establish a relationship based on respect? So I decided that I would no longer humiliate my men, that I would no longer punish them physically, and that I would, you know, work on this, on building this relationship based on respect. And that didn't sit too well with my leadership. You know, they wanted me to inject more testosterone in my leadership style, and to be more of you know, a mean infantry squad leader. And I just wouldn't go for that. And then after that, you know, the soundness of our missions, you know, was lacking very much, because commanders were really bent on instigating firefights so they could get the glory they needed to get promoted. And I began to question that. I began to say, why are we going out here without any face lines? Why are we not calling our position? You know, why are we not determining, you know, alternate routes, you know, to escape or to get supplies, you know, in case that we need backup and things like that? Because the entire thing was designed to precisely, you know, expose ourselves and to, you know, do everything within our power to instigate firefights so that, you know, a few commanders could get their medals and their promotions and things like that. So I began to question that. But again, it was a pretty scary environment. It was pretty intense. So I just didn't really have the courage at the time to speak out more openly on behalf of the Iraqis and say, you know, these are people, you know, we should not be treating them this way. We should not be cruel and brutal to them. Instead, I said, you know, we're not winning their hearts and minds, and they're going to attack us if we act this way, because I was afraid to be perceived as softy and to be perceived as, you know, not having my mind on the mission. But it wasn't really until I got home, you know, away from the danger and away from all that intensity, that I really went back to the political questions, to the political analysis, now adding my on-the-ground experience and now adding the questions of, you know, should have we even been there in the first place? Should have we done all the things that we did, abused prisoners, you know, killed civilians, you know, raided people's homes at 3 a.m, arrested people for no reason and things like that. To me, the key point was to have the security and the peace of mind and the clarity to be able to go back to those questions and ask myself about my own role in the war and my own conscience. And, you know, I was really forced to make a decision at that point.
And you chose not to go back.
And I realized I would not go back. I didn't really choose not to go back because it was such a hard decision. It was so scary to basically say, you know, this is wrong and I'm just not going to do it and I'm just going to speak out about it, because I was so afraid of being rejected by my peers, afraid of being called a coward and a traitor, and afraid of court-martial, you know, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, they still have the death penalty for desertion in a time of war. So I was really afraid of the consequences, and I just didn't have the moral fortitude to wake up one day and say, this is the path I'm going to follow. This is what I'm going to do from now on. I simply didn't get back on the plane when I was supposed to get back on the plane. And I convinced myself that I would go back the next day. And then the next day I would say to myself, you know, I'll go back the next day. Until one day I just realized that, no, you know, I've really made a decision that I'm not going back, and I have to start getting ready for what's coming my way.
And eventually, didn't you turn yourself in?
I did turn myself in eventually. You know, I gathered the strength. It was a painful, scary process of a self-exploration. You know, eventually I ended up in this place called the Peace Abbey in Sherbourne, Massachusetts. And the place is a multi-faith sanctuary for peace and nonviolence, which basically tells the story of many people who have sacrificed their lives for peace. And, you know, it just points out the atrocities and the tragedy of war. And I remember seeing this one wall inside of one of the homes at the Peace Abbey that had pictures of children, you know, who were, you know, missing limbs because of landmines, and people, you know, babies who were born with horrible deformities because of depleted uranium contamination. And seeing all of that basically humbled me and put my own fear into perspective. And I realized that whatever came my way was nothing compared to the damage that war inflicts upon humanity. So I was able to come forward and to say, you know, whatever comes my way, it's nothing. You know, I have to do this. I have to speak out. I have to, you know, do my part in creating awareness about what we're doing in Iraq. And so, you know, on March 15th of 2004, I went public with my opposition to the war and with my refusal to go back to Iraq.
And how do you compare serving time in prison as serving time in the military?
Well, serving time in Iraq particularly was a time when, looking back at that time, I feel like I wasn't really free, because there were so many things that were so objectionable on so many different levels that I was simply not able to oppose, because I was afraid and because the situation was so intense that I was too concerned with surviving. And so I had no shackles, I had no handcuffs on me. But, you know, I was a prisoner of my own fear, in that I was not able to follow my conscience and say, this is what my conscience is telling me to do, this is what I'm going to do. Whereas when I was in jail, obviously I was behind bars and all that, and I couldn't go see my family or anything. But I had certainty in me that I had followed my conscience, and that, you know, because of that, I was a free person.
So how did you use that experience then to find an organization like IVAW and carry that on to others?
Well, you know, people in the military are people before they are soldiers, before they are Marines, before they are, you know, airmen and women. We have a conscience before we join the military. And the conscience, you know, it's not only that which tells you right from wrong, but also which gives you a real hard time, you know, once you come back from a situation like a war and, you know, you're dealing with all these things that you did. And it makes it really hard to look at yourself in the mirror every morning. So having said that, you know, people in the military, you know, all have a conscience and they all have a calling. My calling was, you know, don't go back to the war and speak out about it. But other people in the military, you know, who've had similar experiences as mine have received different callings. You know, for some of them, it has been, you know, exposing torture. For some of them, it has been, you know, refusing to go out on a mission and organizing within their units. For other people, it has been not deploying and then speaking out before they deployed. So it's a place, you know, where you can reach out to those people and say, hey, look, you know, you're not alone. You know, if you want to oppose this war because you object to it, you know, we got your back, and you know, you're still part of this family. Only now we're not, you know, doing what we're told to do by them, you know, but we're actually engaged in a different mission, which is that to undo the damage that we've inflicted on Iraq.
Do you have a sense for how many people have made the choice similar to you and are no longer serving or have deserted?
Well, the last figure that I heard was 40,000 people had either gone AWOL or deserted the military since the beginning of the invasion. 40,000 people. Of them, about maybe 40 or 50 have gone public with their opposition to the war and why they chose not to to go back. A lot of them are in Canada right now. But it's really hard to tell how many of those people, you know, within the 40,000 people have deserted the military because of conscience or because of political opposition to the war. I think the military is doing a pretty good job at creating disaffection within the ranks, because you have people who have been deployed 3 and 4 and 5 times even, and who are coming back home, you know, with severe cases of post-traumatic stress disorder, with failure to readjust to civilian life in the case of, you know, guardsmen and people in the reserves. And the response by the government has been rather irresponsible and cruel, because a lot of these people, you know, are having to wait months to even see a caseworker, to then be told, you know, you're a drunk and we're not going to help you, or to say, come back in 6 months, you know, for an interview with a psychiatrist. And then there's the issue of the equipment. You know, we're paying billions of dollars, you know, on these wars, and yet you have people out there who are going out without the proper equipment, you know, without the proper radio equipment. In my unit, we had to suspend patrols at one point between the hours of 11 in the morning and 6 in the afternoon, because in such high temperatures, we only had 2 bottles of water per soldier. So it makes people wonder, you know, does the military really care about us serving here, or is this all just about, you know, making huge profits for, you know, the corporations that are operating here? So a lot of the resistance, you know, to the occupation, a lot of the disaffection with the military is not necessarily coming from a political understanding or a historical understanding of, you know, U.S. military interventions or the war in Iraq in particular, but because of the way that the military is mistreating, you know, its own young men and women. So it's hard to tell how many people have followed the same path that I followed, you know, just a path of conscience and understanding of what's happening in Iraq, or how many of them have actually decided, you know, I don't want to serve, you know, for this institution anymore, you know, that doesn't really care about us or anybody else.
So give me some specifics. As the chair of the board of directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War, if you were suddenly put in charge of... you were made Secretary of Defense for Obama's new administration. What specific changes would you enact?
Well, I would withdraw troops from both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I would, you know, our 3 points of unit, I would bring everybody home. I would make sure that, you know, all the people who've served in the military have the proper care that they need, that we provide housing assistance, that we provide employment assistance, that we provide proper medical care for people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, people suffering from physical injuries and things like that. And I would propose a plan to start looking at the possibility to pay for reparations for both the people in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the damage that we've inflicted upon them, and because of the destruction that we have brought to their countries.
And what other programs are IVIW currently working on? Do you have a truth in recruiting program?
We do. I mean, our main focus is on organizing GI resistance. So in that sense, you know, we're concentrating on the veteran community, the recent veteran community, and the active duty bases. Right now, we are opening up. Actually, we opened it about 3 days ago, a GI coffee house in the Fort Lewis area in a town called Tillicum, and it's called Coffee Strong. And people can find out about it at givoice.org. And this is one of the things that we're doing. Another thing that we're doing is we have the Winter Soldier hearings. And we just recently had one in Portland, and there was one in Seattle before that, right after the one in the main one that we had outside of D.C. And this is a time when many of our members and people in the military got together to talk about our experiences in both Iraq and Afghanistan, which also included testimony by people from both Iraq and Afghanistan who talked about their experiences on the receiving end of the occupations. So we do this also, again, to create awareness and to send a message to young men and women serving in the military or who have recently served in the military to know that they're not alone in their opposition to the war, and that if they want to speak out, you know, IBAW is a place where they can do that. So, again, our main focus is on the military and recent veterans. But, yeah, we also have members who are actively engaged in, you know, going to high schools and, you know, going to community college where, you know, young people are being recruited into the military. As a matter of fact, I was at a high school yesterday in the Bellingham area speaking to two classrooms, and then after that I went to a community college. So that's a big part of our work. You know, it's not just in the military. Our main focus is GI resistance, but, you know, we're also reaching out to students and to young people who are being recruited by the military.
Question I'd meant to ask you earlier, when you were talking about working with your squad and moving over from, instead of using fear, to using respect, how did your squad respond to that?
The people under my command responded quite well. It was the leadership who didn't like that very much. Again, because, you know, the leadership model in the infantry and perhaps in the whole military, you know, it's based on, you know, this attitude of being really tough and being really firm and instilling fear and respect through fear. And I moved away from that, and that was a big no-no for my leaders. But my squad members really really appreciated that. And as a matter of fact, even after I refused to go back to Iraq and after my surrender and during my court-martial, members of my squad came to the court-martial and testified in my defense in open court. So we were able to build a very strong relationship based on respect.
Do you think you could have a military that would be run on respect rather than fear?
Well, I think that you would have to change the whole system right now. Right now, we operate under a system that's profit-driven, and it's very hard to change the military, you know, in and of itself, you know, when you have a system that's so opposite from that principle, you know, which is a principle of respect. I think we would have to have a whole new system in the United States, you know, which is based on respect for life and human interest rather than profit. And if we're able to have that, which is a much bigger question, but if we're able to change that system, then yeah, I think the military could be a reflection of that.
All right. So, final question, how can people find out more about IBAW?
Well, by visiting our website, Iraq Veterans Against the War, our website is www.ivaw.org. And to find out more about how to get involved in the GI Coffee House in Tillicum, they can go to givoice.org. So givoice.org, Coffee Strong, GI Coffee House, check it out. Help us. You know, we need your help.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me here.